So SSM Healthcare System. Arguing for HMOW is Thomas Piper. Mr. Piper, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Attorney Munson. This case presents the question of whether minority discounts may be applied by trial courts in determining the fair value of a dissenter's shares in a Wisconsin dissenter's rights case. The answer to that question is found in the principles of statutory construction, which require statutes to be construed according to their plain meaning. The plain meaning of the Wisconsin Dissenters' Rights Statute is that the legislature intended trial courts to have broad discretion to use whatever appraisal methods were appropriate in a particular case for determining the fair value question. The statutes leave to the trial courts the question of how to determine fair value on a case-by-case basis. A rule to exclude minority discounts as a matter of law is not only in contravention of those statutes, but it will lead necessarily to the result that in some cases there will be an unfair determination where the evidence would show that a minority discount would be appropriate. This is such a case. The trial court, after hearing all of the evidence in this case, including all the factual evidence that Sisters of St. Mary's, to whom I will refer to as SSM, refers to in its briefs, and correctly made the determination that, in fact, SSM, in this case, received more than fair value. By engrafting onto the statutes an absolute blanket prohibition against minority discounts, the Court of Appeals ruled that the trial court's fairness determination should not stand despite the evidence. This court should reverse that finding and find that, inconsistent with the statutes, trial courts have the discretion to apply minority discounts where appropriate.
And how would that discretion be used? What's appropriate in this case for a minority discount?
Well, in this case, based on the facts presented, the court found that a minority discount of 30% was appropriate.
Why?
Sisters of St. Mary's offered no evidence of its own in the trial court as to any other discount.
Well, why do you want any discount in this case? I mean, you're making the assumption there has to be a minority discount.
No, I am not. I am making the assumption that the trial court should have the discretion to decide whether a minority discount should apply.
I want to know from you what are the factors that would allow a minority discount in some cases and not in others.
The minority discounts were created for purposes of allowing a minority shareholder to object to any particular corporate activity that would take place. Originally, they had absolute veto, but the reason for them is to protect the minority shareholder against oppressive majority profit-taking or oppressive majority motives to squeeze out a minority shareholder. If you are in a...
It seems to me that... The goal of 180.1301 is to allow the majority to proceed by doing a buyout.
The goal is indeed to allow the majority to proceed.
So you allow the majority to proceed and you give the minority shareholder a fair value.
Correct. Not a fair market value.
I know, I said fair value.
But fair value, Your Honor, is intended to be broader than fair market value. It's intended to allow the trial court to take into consider all the evidence with appraisal.
Okay. So why would you give a minority discount in one case and not in another?
All right. Let's suppose you had a situation where The fair value definition is before the transaction and without regard to the transaction, with no appreciation considered because of the transaction. Let's say there were a circumstance where a sale was imminent, a liquidity sale for dollars. There were 8 offers pending. It was certain within the last year prior to the transaction that one of those offers was going to be accepted. Without regard to this particular transaction, it was clear that a minority shareholder would get a pro rata share of dollars. If that minority shareholder dissented and said that he or she did not like the particular offer, and a minority discount was applied, it would be our position that that would penalize the shareholder for asserting minority or dissenter's rights, because it was very clear that there was going to be a pro rata distribution.
Now, why was that clear?
Pardon me?
Why was it clear?
Well, in the hypothetical I posited, there was going to be a sale for dollars. All shares were going to be redeemed, and all shareholders were going to get dollars in exchange. In that situation, there isn't a minority discount applicable.
Okay.
Now, if you have a different situation, let's take a situation where there is a merger transaction that takes place. There is no attempt to squeeze out any shareholders. For instance, in this case, where the minority shareholders were asked to continue to participate, there is going to be a share-for-share exchange. The minority shareholders going in will be minority shareholders coming out on the other side of the transaction. If those minority shareholders who simply get shares back want to sell their shares after the transaction, they will be doing so on the market, and there will be a minority discount applied because they don't have a controlling share. In that case, why should the minority shareholder who dissents, in essence, get a premium? They will be getting more than any of the other minority shareholders who go along with the transaction.
Well, then, is it your position every time you have a share-for-share exchange, there's a minority discount?
No, not if there is oppression involved, not if it is a share-for-share exchange, for instance, by an affiliate. Under the Wisconsin Dissenters' Rights Statutes in 1984, 1983 Wislaws 200, business combinations were added for the publicly traded corporation. If you have a publicly traded corporation and there is some type of transaction, the market bears. But in a business transaction, there is a acquisition by either a majority shareholder or an affiliate. And an affiliate could be a parent who does nothing other than a share-for-share exchange.
Here's my problem with what you said. You said that after the transaction, if the minority shareholder wanted to sell the new stock on the market, they would it would be discounted.
It probably would be discounted twice for lack of marketability also.
Okay, that's my point. You are now, but when you say that, you are equating fair value with fair market value. Because you're saying, hey, fair value for the minority shareholder shouldn't be greater than the fair market value if they sold on the market. And if that were true, you would need the difference for fair value.
Well, if I said that, I didn't mean to.
Well, but I mean, you did in effect say that. I mean, that's what I heard, because you said in a share-for-share exchange, after the transaction, the minority shareholder could sell the new shares, and there would be a discount. So why should the minority shareholder get a premium by cashing out before the exchange?
Because,
I mean, that's what you did say.
And that's right. And to answer that question, there may be circumstances where the minority shareholder should get a premium if the reason for the share-for-share exchange is a squeeze-out.
Well, in other words, your position is the minority shareholder gets fair market value unless there's oppression or a squeeze-out, then you get a premium.
Well, in that case, I wouldn't call it a premium. I would call it the fair value. That's why there's a sliding scale for fair value, and it isn't tied to fair market value.
All right. Then, if I understand your position, minority shareholder gets fair market value unless there's a pressure or a squeeze out, at which point it gets more than fair market value, and that equals fair value.
It could, because the distinction between what the discount will be is also for the trial court. It could be zero, it could be 10%, it could be 20%, depending upon the particular facts.
So the...
it seems to me you should object to my statement that they get a fair market value. There's no oppression.
Fair market value, Your Honor, I believe, can be a component of the fair value determination. I mean, they could certainly get fair market value if, in the fair value determination by the court, based on all the evidence, that was the appropriate compensation.
And the difficulty you're having, as I gather it, with the Court of Appeals decision is basically they've created this whole bright line. They've created, and I'm just reading that the appraised fair value should be equal to the shareholder's share of the corporation. So that's, as I take it, you're saying that's very simplistic in the sense that it's easy to figure out because you have 1,000 shares and you have so many minorities, so many majority, and therefore the minority stockholder should get this much, therefore not a, quote, discounted value. As the trial judge, you're saying, should have this, and I think this is what the Chief Justice was trying to eke out, was just when this discretion would come into play, how we would be able to have a, if you wrote an opinion, a standard that we could set that would recognize this type of discretion that the trial court would be allowed to have. Because under the Court of Appeals, if I understand this, and I'm just reading that, we conclude that minority discounts are inappropriate under dissenters' rights statute. These statutes were intended to be a trade-off, and then they go on. And what you're saying is, well, wait a minute, it's not one size fits all, and it just, under these facts, it doesn't work.
Yes.
Okay.
I have a number of problems with the part that you referenced in the Court of Appeals. For one thing, they equated the investment that a minority shareholder makes with the pro rata share of the value of the corporation as a continuing enterprise, and that's just simply wrong, because you don't pay the pro rata share of a corporation on a share-by-share basis. But what the Court of Appeals did was create a blanket prohibition. Thou shalt never use minority discounts. And even in many of the cases that apparently SSM believes line up on their side of the scale that say never, and those that say that do, while we believe it's a pretty much an equal split, they don't create blanket prohibitions. The Minnesota court has referenced Missouri cases saying that there's a blanket prohibition, when in fact the very case they cite, which we've quoted in our brief, say it is up to the discretion of the trial court. So what we object to is there is nothing in the language of the statute that you can read that says thou shalt not use minority discounts. The statutes, in fact, allow the court to have its own appraiser to determine how to set the fair value. And the legislature could have said, but the appraiser can't use a minority discount. And nowhere does that exist. Now, with regard to the standard, I submit that it's in the statute. There are three classifications of shareholders that are identified under the statute. Two relate to publicly traded corporations. One says a publicly traded corporation that goes through a transaction of this kind, there's a stock market exception. You cannot have a fair value determination. That sets the value that dissenting shareholder at a minority discounted price, because that's what's reflected in the stock market. The business combination, where there is oppression. It is defined as a majority shareholder purchasing or an affiliate purchasing. There's a distinction. And the court said there, although the court defined, or I'm sorry, the legislature defined it as fair market value, it really isn't fair market value. It is the last price within 30 days prior to the transaction, which is going to be higher than a minority discounted value because since it's a public company, the news on the street is going to be that there's a transaction. Now, the legislature has made that distinction with publicly traded corporations. If it's oppression, if it's a squeeze out, if it's acquisition where the minority is going to be gone, they will get a value for fair value that is not discounted necessarily by a minority discount. In the other circumstances, it is. Now, why does that same distinction not apply to allow a trial court to look at the exact same criteria? Why can't a trial court decide with the help of an appraiser that in this particular case there should be a distinction? If it is a squeeze out, you will not necessarily apply a minority discount, or in fact you may, but it might depend upon the percentage that is applied for a minority discount. In the other circumstances, you will apply a minority discount because it doesn't fit within the policy of why dissenters' rights were created. It is not intended to protect that dissenting shareholder from some type of oppressive conduct.
What is a minority discount?
By definition, a minority discount is to reduce the value of an individual block of shares because it does not have a controlling nature with it.
Well, I should know better. I should ask the question better to get the answer I want. let me ask it differently. Isn't a minority discount premised on marketability? That is, that it's not easily transferable or marketable, maybe because there is less control, you know, for a variety of reasons. But the bottom line, a discount represents marketability. A discount represents impaired marketability.
I do not believe so.
Oh, then what does a discount mean? Why would you discount something 30%? 30% from what?
The shares can be shares traded on the New York Stock Exchange are readily marketable.
Okay, I'm talking about closely held corporations.
But the point, there are two different kinds of discounts. One is a lack of marketability, to which I believe you are referring.
Yes.
There is a minority discount, which is entirely different. Lack of marketability is because it may take an awful long time to be able to sell these shares.
And is the other one lack of control?
Lack of control.
But isn't that really intertwined with lack of marketability? I know it's set out as two separate things, but it seems to me that the reason I pay less in the market is because I have no control. So although they're set out as two distinct reasons, that the first reason, as it was set out, lack of control, is really subsumed or taken into consideration in marketability, and it is really essentially a discount for lack of full value in the marketplace, whether it's because it's not traded publicly or easily traded, but it's not easily traded, it seems to me, because of lack of control. Who wants this stuff?
Well, even the Yahoo shares that have been selling sell very quickly, but you don't buy a controlling share. It certainly reflects the price. It doesn't reflect the ability to market the shares necessarily. Stock restrictions may do that. It may be that it just isn't that sought after a stock. That's why in some cases you add on a different discount because of lack of marketability. The lack of the minority discount is really designed because if you buy this, it may be a great buy, and you may be able to turn around and sell it immediately for a profit, but you aren't going to gain control of the company. If you were going to gain control of the company, I would pay you more. So to a certain extent, yes, they blend, but they are different concepts.
What I am getting to then, and you're guarded about accepting my premise, and I understand that. But if you would accept the premise, it seems rather circuitous then. It seems like if at the essence of a discount is impaired marketability, and yet arguably the reason that the legislature chose fair value rather than fair market value is because you're not to be tied to the market value. And so it seems a rather circuitous...
I certainly agree you're not to be tied to the market value. The market value may define fair value based upon the particular facts in the case. And what we have been exchanging here, I believe, shows how wildly different various stock in various companies may be. And for the court to create a blanket prohibition when there's nothing in the statutes that supports that analysis is to ensure one result. And that is there may be cases where it would be inequitable not to apply a minority discount. And if there's a blanket prohibition, that will result. If instead you leave it to the trial court, every dissenter will have his or her day in court based on all the evidence and is designed to lead to an equitable result. And I think that's what the Wisconsin dissenter statutes were designed to accomplish.
Well, Mr. Piper, one of us is going to have to write a decision. And one of us is going to have to instruct the court. You just don't say, hey, it's up to your discretion. You give the court, the trial court, standards for exercising the discretion of when to use a minority discount and how much. Okay. So what is your standard? One standard you gave us, it was, if it's just a cash transaction, no minority discount. The other standard you gave us is that if there's oppression or shove out, then maybe no minority discount. Right? What is the standard that you would like to see in an opinion that would tell the trial court what to do in these situations?
The trouble with creating a legal standard that's based upon specifics is trying to create it to handle all of the facts that would be pertain to a particular transaction. We are legally trained. We are not appraisers. And the legislature understood that. That's why the legislature expressly provided that the court can appoint an appraiser to advise it. So,
counsel, you know, if you get 10 appraisers, you'll get 15 opinions.
Yeah.
And in this case, you got an appraiser. You brought in the appraisal. And the leaders in the corporation went back and said, hey, you got the wrong growth value.
True.
And so he came back and he changed it. So you got two appraisals from one appraiser there. And so maybe if my math is wrong, maybe I should just double it. So you have to still even tell the appraiser what the standards are for appraising it.
Other than what the legislature has done here, which is to say, you have to think of the purpose for which the dissenters' rights statutes were created, and that is to protect the minority shareholder in the circumstance where they're getting squeezed out.
Okay, so maybe the Court of Appeals is wrong here, if they're wrong, maybe what they had to say was there should be no minority discount under the facts of this case, which is share for share, and everybody's a minority shareholder, and there's no squeeze out, and there's no oppression. So under those circumstances, when there are a minority going in and a minority going out, no oppression, no fraud, etc., no discount. It's like a cash transaction.
It would certainly be our case, a situation that in a case that was actually like that, that there would be no reason for having, or there would be a reason for having, there would be no reason for having, sorry, there would be a reason for a minority discount. The reason is you're minority going in, you're all minority going out, anybody who wants to market their sales, their shares would have a minority discount. So I would say in the facts you said, that would be a situation which would call for a minority discount. What level, I don't know, because it would depend upon a lot of things the appraiser would have to say.
Can I ask a couple of questions? Are you saying that when there is a so-called squeeze-out situation, there can never be a minority discount?
I am saying that under, if the sole purpose, for instance, in the Weinberger case, which I'll get to on the plot, is to squeeze out a minority shareholder who wanted to stay but was not allowed to stay in the transaction, it would be a very rare case, if those were all the facts, where a minority discount would be in order.
Even if the minority is engaging in misconduct and really working against the interests of the corporation?
Well, again, that's the problem with trying to define one standard based upon any given facts. If the facts were that there were some type of misconduct that led to this, then it probably wouldn't be defined as a pure squeeze-out. And in that situation, either it would reduce the minority discount to be applied, or it would negate it all together if the court found that the conduct of the minority shareholder did not reach the level of trying to squeeze that person out. But that's why it has to be left to the trial.
Can I ask another question? When appraisers appraise real property, there are manuals that they can go to for standards. Are there manuals that deal with this kind of property that could speak to minority or to discounts?
Well, one of the pieces of evidence submitted in the trial court was an article by Shannon Pratt, who is readily recognized as one of the foremost leaders in valuations. And he has written many treatises, and in fact, there were standards that apply to appraisers that were introduced for the court to review. And the court, considering all of that evidence, felt that in this case, the fair value would include a minority discount. I see that I'm out of time.
Are there any other questions? Mr. Piper, thank you. You have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Mr. Martin, representing FSM Healthcare System.
My name is Earl Munson, and with me at council table is Peter Ritz. We represent the minority shareholder. The trial court in this case ruled as a matter of law that minority discounts were required in a dissenter's rights case. That ruling was procured by or urged by HMOW in the trial court. It is now abandoned in this court and in this argument by HMOW. The issue here then, or issues I should say, is the Court of Appeals right that there is no minority discounts under Wisconsin law? If so, or if there are minority discounts, what are the criteria for imposing them, and are there those criteria in evidence in this case? Both of us, that is, both sides, have cited case law from other jurisdictions. And I don't mean to talk about those cases, but I'd like to bring to your attention the fact that those cases show a trend in which the courts have now decided to reject minority discounts in dissenters' rights cases. The last case which ruled in favor of minority discounts, that is, took up the issue and ruled as a policy that minority discounts should be allowed, was in 1991. Nebraska in 1994, on the other hand, ruled no minority discounts. In 1995, New York. In 1999, Vermont ruled no discounts. New Jersey ruled no discounts in 1999. Remarkably, while we were briefing this case, the Supreme Court of Kansas reversed itself and ruled no minority discounts. 1 year before, Montana reversed itself and ruled no minority discounts. That says, I think, that those courts, in reading the law review articles and the treatises on this subject, and considering the litigation that has gone on, have not been able to justify a minority discount in a dissenter's rights case.
Now, is your position an absolutist position?
Our position is that the statute, the Wisconsin statute, does not permit minority discounts.
And that's under, you heard opposing counsel talk about some other considerations. Are you saying that under no situation would minority discounts be allowed? That's
yes. And let me state why that is true.
Even if there's oppression, even if there's conflict of interest, even if other issues come up so that the minority shareholder is working against the corporation, no discount.
Well, but if that is the case, that's not a dissenter's rights case. That's a breach of fiduciary duty. Stockholders, after all, have fiduciary duties to one another. And to the extent that a stockholder abuses his or her right, that's a different lawsuit. It is not a dissenter's rights case.
If you take that position, then is the argument upon which you came up on cross-review, that's one of their arguments, that it's not a dissenter case.
That's true. But in that issue, our position is that the HMOW manipulated the dissenter's rights process.
By the valuation?
Yes, actually starting earlier than that. That the manipulation started with the report or going to the stockholders. That there is a requirement under the dissenter's rights statute that the corporation advise the stockholders prior to the merger vote that this is a merger and that those stockholders, those shareholders, have dissenter's rights. Indeed, it is required in that report that the statutory provisions be sent to the shareholders. In addition, once the shareholder receives that report, that shareholder must give notice in writing under the statute that it intends to exercise its dissenter's rights, and it must then vote against the merger or the share-for-share exchange or what have you. Finally, then, there is the letter that Mr. Barrick sent in which he did a turnabout, in which he went from $16.5 to $18 million down to $7 million. And that, too, was required by statute. And he wrote a letter that he said, we estimate the value of this company to be at about $7 million. He agreed at trial that that was not something he really believed in. It was not a net worth valuation. He didn't believe in net worth. So that he sent a letter as a part of the dissenter's rights procedure, which he knew didn't really believe. It was not an honest letter. Our suggestion then is that in the procedures, those statutory procedures leading up to and including the commencement of this action, that the HMOW has done a turnaround and must be stopped from arguing that the number that they used to procure the merger is not the number that is fair value.
What was the fair value?
Pardon me?
What was the fair value?
The trial court found, and one of the problems with this argument, sir, is that the trial court found that fair market value of this corporation was $10.5 million, not the $16.5 to $18 million that was represented to the shareholders.
Didn't you have a valuation that was even higher?
We came into a valuation, sir, that was at about $19.2 million.
Fair market value or fair value?
Fair market value of the entity.
Your answer is both, did you say?
I'm sorry.
Fair market value and?
Of the entity, of the enterprise, the total company.
Well, who has the right to decide what fair value?
Court has the right to decide what is fair value.
What standards does the court apply?
We suggest that in deciding on the issue that we've raised with respect to the fairness of the conduct of HMOW, that the standard is that they are held to the number that they use to obtain the merger they desire.
Suppose there wasn't such evaluation.
That is, at the point of time of the merger, then they're not held to any, they didn't make any representations. That they didn't, there was no turnaround. There's no.
How does the court then determine what the value is?
And the court then determines the fair market value of the enterprise and determines the proportional value of that stock.
Well, would your position be that the standards for appraisers do not include any provisions for minority discount?
Yes.
And what would you say to Mr. Piper's argument about Mr. was it Pratt or something to that effect?
But what Mr. Pratt said was that, in fact, out there in the market, there are people do not pay the same for a minority stock that they pay for majority stock. I agree with that. That's true. But we're dealing with a situation in which there is no market. These are closely held corporations. These are mom and pop corporations in which there is no market out there.
So
it's a theoretical market.
The court should simply disregard the market?
There is no market, and the court should disregard the market, and we suggest that the Wisconsin legislature, in fact, said that. The Wisconsin legislature defined fair value. And it defined fair value in an ambiguous way for purposes of the dissenters' rights in the closely held corporation. It said fair value is that value immediately before the transaction without taking into consideration the transaction. But in the very next sentence, the legislature said fair value for a business combination is market value. That means that at least for the dissenters' rights in a closely held corporation, the legislature did not use the term market value in the very next sentence, and they intended not to use the term market value. Once that happens, once the legislature says that market value is not a criteria for fair value, we're done. There is no more discussion with respect to minority discounts because minority discounts depend upon market. We argue also that there's another section of the statute which equates proportional distribution with fair value. Section 180.1302 sub 1 sets forth the circumstances in which a shareholder in a closely held corporation can exercise or has the right to dissenters' rights. One, for a merger. Two, for a share-for-share exchange. Subsection C provides that if all or substantially all of the assets of the corporation are sold, a minority shareholder can exercise dissenters' rights and receive the fair value of his or her stock. But, said the legislature, but there is no dissenters' rights if all of the assets of the corporation are sold and distributed to the stockholders in 1 year. If all of the assets are sold for cash and distributed within 1 year, there is no dissenters' rights. The shareholder has received fair value, and the legislature has set up an equation. Fair value is proportional distribution, because that's what happens when the assets are distributed.
Counsel, I look at the Court of Appeals opinion, and as I read it, I hope I'm not unfairly characterizing it has a rather simplistic approach. It says, look, the language is ambiguous. We can't discern the intent by any legislative history or by looking at the context or the normal tools of legislative interpretation. So let's look to other jurisdictions. They're split. So now what do we do? Well, let's look to the purpose. They cite the purpose in the Minnesota case, which is, look, giving discounts or not giving discounts will benefit one side or the other. The purpose of these statutes is to benefit the minority shareholder. That's the answer. Now, maybe I'm wrong in characterizing the Court of Appeals opinion so simplistically, but are you in agreement with the analysis of the Court of Appeals opinion?
No. The Court of Appeals said that the fair value was ambiguous. I agree, the term fair value. But then it said, it is clear that the legislature said it should not be fair market value. We therefore conclude that the legislature did not intend shares of non-business combinations to be valued based on fair market value. Once that is accepted, the discussion with respect to discounts is over, because discounts depend on a market. And if there is no market, if there is no market consideration, we don't have a market.
Mr. Munson, what's the purpose of this statute?
You said the Court of Appeals was wrong. You don't agree with that.
No, I said the Court of Appeals was right with respect. I endorse that where that quote.
And you would not change the Court of Appeals.
I would not go change that quote.
Okay. What would you change? Anything?
With respect to the Court of Appeals decision?
Yeah.
Well, I changed the Court of Appeals decision with respect to my cross petition.
Okay, second then. Okay.
What is the purpose of this statute?
The purpose of the statute is to give a quid pro quo. Minority shareholders had the right to veto sale of assets, veto mergers, veto any significant act of the corporation. That was pretty significant.
Is it exclusively for the protection of the dissenter?
Yes.
So the rights of the remaining shareholders, the majority, whether they're made up of other minority shareholders or otherwise, have no consideration at all in the analysis?
Well, this statute is designed to value a dissenter's right. That is what the statute is about. It is headlined, dissenter's rights. And that's what the statute is for.
But I assume it's for it to be fair. Be fair to the majority and be fair to the minority.
Fair value.
Pardon me?
Fair value, yes.
Fair value. Okay. Then my question is essentially the same as I gave to your opponent, and that is, okay, does the trial court get to fair value? How are we going to do that? What do we instruct the trial court in determining fair value? I mean, you're clear it's no minority discount. Okay, we got that. How do you compute?
You value the enterprise on a fair market value of the enterprise.
Okay, so as if you
all of us do that.
As if you sold the whole thing.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
And that's where the appraisers come in.
Okay.
Appraiser comes in and he values the enterprise. And then it's a proportional distribution. Justice Wilcox said, is that not simplistic? Yes, it's simplistic. But so is the stock market exception. It is simplistic. Whatever the stock market says it is, that's what it is, whether the stock market's fair or not. Counsel argues, and the trial court argued, that it was not fair to eliminate minority discounts for a closely held corporation when they are, in fact, embedded in the sale of stock in the public arena. But the legislature knew that there was a dramatic difference between those people who invest in closely held corporations and those who invest in the stock market. Closely held corporations are people who gather, pool their money, in order to invest in a business and hope that that business will succeed. It's moms and pops supporting their children, grandparents, helping their grandchildren, the family corporate farm. Whatever it is people investing and pooling their assets in the enterprise and hoping that the enterprise is successful. Conversely, on the other side, at the public stock market, it is people buying a piece of paper, and they hope that piece of paper goes up in value. True, they want a good company. They want a bad company. But what they're investing in is they're investing in the paper. They're investing in the rise in the stock market and the gamble that the stock market will produce them an income. That is a dramatically different circumstance. And the legislature then created, as a part of the anti-takeover law, a business combination exception, which is dramatically different, as counsel pointed out. That came about as a result of the breweries being taken over by takeover artists back in the early 80s. And part of that statutory procedure was the business combination and the valuation of it. And as counsel pointed out, the legislature said in that event that dissenter, the public shareholder does get some dissenter's rights, and he or she gets the value at the highest price during the close of business during a 30-day period. The highest price, a spiked price. There is nothing equivalent. Contrary to the trial court's ruling, there's nothing equivalent with respect to the public shareholder, with respect to the closely held shareholder, or the business combination shareholder. Counsel argues for criteria.
Before you get to that, if I may, a digression that's been bothering me. Most of these closely held corporations oftentimes have buy-sell agreements, and then they value the either by dollar amount or formula, the value of the stock. What implication do those kind of buy-sell agreements have in, if not this case, in the decision that the court will be writing? I'm concerned about the ramifications.
I think none, because to the extent that the buy-sell agreement is triggered by a stockholder, it is outside the context of a merger or a sale. Then they'll go through the merger or the sale, but they can trigger contractually the buy-sell agreement. Now, one of the articles cited by the HMOW is a University of Pennsylvania law review. It's a long, lengthy article, will put you to sleep very well. And he concludes, he discusses the Delaware no minority shares. He concludes that Delaware is right, there shouldn't be any minority discounts. But he says there's one exception. There ought to be an exception when the agree. They know up front that there will be a minority discount in the event of a merger share-for-share exchange. Now, that doesn't change my analysis of the Wisconsin law. All that says is that in some case, if that happens, coming up before this court, you will have to decide whether a article of incorporation or a bylaw can change, contractually change, the requirement of the statute. But the requirement of the statute that we submit is quite clear. Counsel says that the SSM decided not to join the PAC, and therefore there ought to be a minority discount. Therefore there ought to be a penalty. And nowhere does the statute say that. That's created out of whole cloth. But are we really going to litigate that issue? Are we really going to litigate when the Wisconsin Investment Board invests in a closely held Wisconsin corporation, and it is then taken over by a New York corporation or an English corporation or a French corporation, and the Wisconsin Investment Board says, I don't want to be part of that. I assert my dissenter's rights. Are we going to say, in that circumstance, you must submit to a minority discount? That's not what the legislature said. They're not going to look at the motives for joining or not joining the transaction. That's not the type of litigation this is. I've already discussed the fairness question, that is, the trial court's argument that it must be fair. Respectfully submit that then there are no criteria. There are no circumstances in which a minority discount, a penalty, if you will, based upon a theoretical market, should be imposed. After all, what counsel argues when there argues for a minority discount in certain circumstances, what HMOW says is that when the grandparents or the parent invest in a corporation, the very next day, that investment is 20 or 30% less if they don't do certain things or if there is a dissenter's rights case. Legislature didn't intend that. With respect to the estoppel and unfair conduct issue, it is an issue which, in some sense, supports a distorted view of what the legal system is about. That is, anything is fair in love and war, and this is war. Mr. Barracks gave a warm endorsement of the VR report, $16.5 to $18 million. Not only that, he participated in the valuation. Mr. Bradabo, the VR appraisers, testified and tells us that Mr. Barracks and his management team called him after the first report and said, your number's too high. $23 million is not the fair value or fair market value of this enterprise, because we have found in our negotiations with our 10 partners that your number is too high. Nothing can support that. And the number was lowered. Mr. Barracks also told Mr. Bradabo that the previous information he had given him, or that there's management had given him, with respect to growth presumption predictions, were wrong. They were wrong because of the Fox River Valley, and that those growth estimates had to be changed. They were changed. Mr. Barracks also was worried about the spread. There wasn't a big enough spread between the value of the company standing alone and the value of the new LLC partnership. And sure enough, VR changed that spread. It was greater. Once those changes were made, Mr. Barracks endorsed that report, and he sent it to the stockholders, and he recommended the stockholders approve the merger. It is not unfair to say that the stockholders voted for that merger, understanding that the dissenters' rights, and they knew who the dissenters were because they had to give notice of it, that the dissenters would receive their proportionate share of $16.5 to $18 million. The majority voted on that assumption. I've already indicated that Mr. Barracks then wrote his letter in January of 1995, in which he gave an estimate which he really didn't believe. This case was filed in April of 1995. HMOW did not retain their expert to countermand Mr. Bradabo until August of 1996, over a year and a half later, almost a year and a half later. There was then no appraisal to support the change in circumstances or the change in position that Mr. Barracks announced in his letter of January. It was strictly something that he was required to do as a result of the new owner of the corporation. I have said that I had two problems with this argument. One, the trial court found fair market value to be $10.5 rather than the $16.5, $18 million. Two, what is the legal pigeonhole that I put my argument? With respect to the difference between the fair market value and fair value, it is just that. That is, that since the company procured the merger, they are held to a fair value, which is the represented value. And the fair market value does not count. With respect to the legal theory...
That's a blanket rule.
Your Honor, my position is that, you know, the rule that I urge, that when a corporation or its management uses an appraisal to obtain a desired sale or merger triggering dissenters' rights, the company may not, in a subsequent dissenters' rights procedure, urge a fair value less than it previously represented to its shareholders. That's the rule I would urge the court to adopt. Thank you.
Counsel, before you sit down, I'm looking at the article by Dorr from New Richmond. Did he have any involvement in writing the statute or the predecessor statute that we are dealing with now?
I'm sorry, looking at...
There's an article by W.T. Dorr, Jr., Protection of Minority Shareholders' Rights, and I think that's cited in I think it's your brief several times.
I don't know the answer to that, whether he had anything to do with writing the dissenters' rights. The dissenters' rights statute dates back into the early 50s, and it is in many ways a statute which is a model statute.
The reason I ask is because as I read his article, it sounded to me like when he was addressing the issue of fair value, he was kind of arguing, I think, what would be consistent with your opponent's position in part. That is, be flexible. And fair value, he says, page 35, it says it needs interpretation and that it could be the liquidated value, sometimes might be higher than market value, and sometimes it might be market value that would be fair value. And I'm just wondering what weight, if any, to give to his article, and that's why I asked the threshold question if he was one of the drafters of the legislation.
I don't know, but I do not argue that the court should not be flexible. What I do argue is the court cannot use within that flexibility this
fair market value,
because the legislature said you can't do that. And secondly, it's phony. There isn't any market.
Counsel, I just wanted to not perhaps correct in my own mind, but as I look at the statute, these statutes were around, I think they came around in 1989.
The dissenters' rights statute?
Yeah, you were saying in the early 50s, but I was looking at the wrong one, I think it's 1989. I may be wrong.
I don't think it was 1989.
Okay.
The history here just usually goes back 10 years and doesn't, you'd have to
look up. I used to have to look at that. And that's why I thought when we were talking about some of the cases, you know, we got a split out in the jurisdictions, and you indicated there has not been a case since the, since 91 that has gone for the opponents to stand here. They've all been in the other direction. So I'm just looking at when the legislation came around.
I think the legislation has been on the books for some time. It's really remarkable that this case has been so long in coming before this court.
Could I ask, when HMOW was formed, how was it determined how many shares each entity would have?
How much money they put into it? Initially, it was formed as a nonprofit organization. Then, because of some changes in regulations, it was changed to a profit corporation. But your shares were dependent upon how much money you contributed, the shareholder contributed, just like any other contribution. And the corporation is made up of providers to HMOW. That is, it was at that time made up of providers to HMOW. You had to be a provider, and if the shareholder did not continue to be a provider, the shareholder then had to sell.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr.
Munson.
Mr.
Keisberg,
you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is not a factual error-correcting court. And listening to Mr. Munson's argument on manipulation, those are the same factual arguments he made to the trial court. They're the same factual arguments that were rejected by the trial court when the court said that the value that was placed on the enterprise was the appropriate value of $10,544,000, and the Court of Appeals affirmed on that basis. Mr. Munson's argument shows the danger in trying to stack up how many states have gone which way. He said the New Jersey case has been added to the list, and he's referring to the Lawson Martin Wheaton Inc. v. Smith. It's a 1999 case cited on page 2 of his brief. That case did not apply to minority discounts. It dealt with lack of marketability discounts, and in fact, when you read the case, it was not a blanket prohibition, but in fact the court recognized that there was an exceptional circumstances exception to when such discounts can be applied. He cited the Kansas case, saying the Kansas Supreme Court reversed itself. That again is not quite accurate. The Supreme Court in Kansas reversed itself with regard to a situation where there is oppression against the minority shareholders, and only to that extent.
Counsel, I note that according to the brief, 1994 ALI came out with a principle of corporate governance that indicated that the application of minority discounts in dissenters' rights cases should be rejected. Has any case since the ALI pronouncement in a state court gone contrary to that pronouncement?
No court that I know of since that recommendation came out has addressed the issue, and we search for that in accordance with the court's procedure to give new authority. No court has adopted that as a blanket prohibition since the ALR recommendation, or ALI, I'm sorry, recommendation. And in fact, it is just that, but when you think of it and think of our statutes, The ALI is recommending a change. The ALI is recommending that something be changed with regard to the standards, and that is something that could be now adopted. If you apply that to our statutes, it means that it was not what has been in the past. That's never been a blanket prohibition in the past, and our statutes have not been changed based on the ALR recommendation. It would be our position that supports us, because you don't need to change something if it always had a blanket prohibition. Now, the standard that Mr. Munson has offered to the court, I think, is instructive. He says that for fair value determination, all one does is value the fair market value of the corporation, and it's over. Every dissenter shareholder now gets a pro rata share of that value. Then I question, where is the fairness element? Where is the fair value determination in those circumstances? Mr. Munson said that all of these corporations are mom-pop corporations that go into these investments with a whole different perspective. Well, it ignores the facts of this case. Sisters of St. Mary's is not a mom-and-pop corporation, and it purchased a 19% share in this because it's a provider, and it was getting referrals for tertiary care out of this organization. It decided not to go along with this, because its competitive exclusivity of tertiary care referrals was being threatened by the introduction of UCare into the mix. This is not a circumstance where all of the cases will be the same. And that's what makes a particular standard so difficult. But I submit it's not any different than any other case where expert witnesses are presenting expert testimony. There are many cases where the trial court sits as a trier of fact with mixed discretion and factual determination responsibilities, hears, as the legislature has suggested here, testimony from appraisers, and comes up with the correct decision. What is being urged on this court is to take away some of the process and say there will never be minority discounts in this mix. And there is nothing to be found in the statutes that supports that analysis to lead, in some cases, to an unfair result where the evidence would show minority discounts should be applied. Thank you.
May I have just one question?
Justice Brasser.
The evaluation by Evaluation Research Corporation, between 16.5 and 18 million, I think it was. Was that a fair value valuation or a fair market value valuation, or what was it?
It was neither. It was an attempt at a fair market valuation. Mr. Munson said that everybody knew dissenters would get a proportionate share of that number. That's not at all supported by the record. It was never an attempt to evaluate a certain block of shares. Also, indisputably, Mr. Bradibo was not experienced, and he left out a very important component, and that was valuing HMOW if, in fact, the UCare and the UWS transaction was to take place, which indisputably it was. And now you had a wholly new competitor. For the very first time, UWS in Western Wisconsin, who now was going to be added to Physicians Plus and Dean Care, and HMOW was already struggling. And it's indisputable on the record that VR did not consider that in putting a valuation on HMOW. The answer to your question is it was an attempt at a fair market value of the entire corporation as a going concern, not for any block of shares and not for fair value. The simple answer is it was incompetently done, and the trial court found that as a matter of fact.
But that was the number given to the shareholders?
That was the number that was given to the shareholders, and the facts, again,
On which they voted,
and there's nothing in the record to support that anybody relied on that, because it was the comparative analysis that they were interested in. Would it be better, would HMOW, which was, they'd already voted, needed a partner, and it was not going to survive alone. It needed this partner. Would HMOW, as a standalone entity, be worth more or less than if it entered into a partnership with UWS? Every valuation, exclusively every valuation presented to the shareholders showed that the comparative value was that the partnership was better than standalone. And that's what they were interested in. And it's also indisputable that Sisters of St. Mary's did not rely on that. They voted against this transaction for purely self-competitive reasons.
Thank you, Mr. Piper. Thank you, Mr. Munson. That ends our oral argument for today. The court's in recess to oral arguments until Tuesday, April